But that is particularly for the undergrads in my undergrad class. I mean, not that you shouldn't come, but
right.
depends upon how upset and everything they are. They all have.
And they are 400.
They have TAs. They have TAs.
They have four TAs.
They have four TAs, and the TAs in principle are a buffer between the students and me. But I do make myself available to undergraduates and encourage them to come and see me if they have any issues in the class. So it depends upon the scene.
If they just turn in the paper or not.
The TAs really have to deal with the papers and stuff in that class. But in any case, I'm there. That's open office hours 2 to 4. I'm happy to make...
Which day is this?
Thursdays.
Thursday.
Thursdays 2 to 4. And there are only a few times this semester when I will be traveling and not be able to. Well, that actually, come to think of it, on December 1st we might have to. Yeah, well, we don't have to worry about that now. It's possible that we won't have a session on December 1st. I'm not sure if everybody knows, I was elected president of the American Sociological Association, and the theme is going to be real utopias. I get to decide the theme for the discipline. As the all-powerful president of the ASA, I can force every sociologist in the country to think about real utopias for 1 year. But it does mean I have these council meetings and executive board meetings, all this kind of organizational stuff in Washington. And there's a meeting on the 2nd and 3rd of December. Probably it means I will have to leave Wednesday afternoon that week. So that's, I don't think that'll disrupt our process at all, since by that point I think our weekly progress report discussions won't be as important as they would be earlier in the process. Okay. I'd like to do one little piece of exposition and then just basically open this up for discussion, since we didn't do interrogations. One person wrote an interrogation, not realizing that I wasn't expecting it for this first week. But I'm sure if you've read the Envisioning Real Utopias discussions, many of you will have agenda items you would have written if you had written interrogations. I wanted, since a lot of what will be in play this semester is trying to give greater conceptual precision to this domain of issues, I wanted to just pass out, here, give me one just so I have it as a... just as a way of illustrating this, and then did I send this as an attachment yet? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've seen. These are two different ways in which, for many different topics, you can work on the problem of clarifying concepts. So, again, some of you have taken other courses from me, as many people have observed, I tend to be more preoccupied with the problem of clarifying concepts than most sociologists. That is, a typical sociologist takes their concepts off the shelf and then builds their theories using off-the-shelf concepts, rather than worrying a lot about the concepts they're using. I make the distinction between the problem of concept formation, or the problem of concept constructing concepts, and the problem of constructing theories. You build theories with concepts. Theories assemble concepts in various ways. But the concepts themselves need clarification and specification and definition. Now, the problem is that the meaning of concepts also comes from the theories in which they're used. So it isn't as if concepts are somehow separate from the theories in which they function. Nevertheless, there are problems of clarifying exactly what the lines of demarcation are between one concept and another, and what the internal structure of a concept is, what its internal dimensions and forms of variation are. And I've spent a lot of time in different parts of my work worrying about that kind of thing. The first half of my academic career focused on the problem of class, and I kind of endlessly obsessed about how best to define class, how to figure out the internal dimensions, what were the precise differences between Marxian and Weberian concepts of class. And I worked and reworked that problem a lot. Some of you have heard the quip that I've given Theda Scotchpole, who's a professor at Harvard, once criticized me in a public forum. It was a friendly tease. I mean, she wasn't being mean, but she said, "I pack my bags for a trip I never take," meaning that I worry about the definitions of concepts rather than just getting on with the business of using them. And I thought that was a little harsh, but there was a grain of truth in it. Like many teases, it does capture something. So I don't think one should obsess about concepts at the expense of developing theories, but nevertheless, building your concepts, being clear about them, understanding lines of demarcation and internal differentiation, that is an important task. And that is part of what we'll be doing this semester. Now, what I've given here are two kinds of templates. These are two useful ways of approaching that problem. The first, the one that's called a grid of organizational forms. This is the simplest way of building concepts. You just create a little menu, an inventory, in which, in this case, the columns are all the different ways in which organizations might vary, and the rows are the different kinds of organizations. And then you try to map out how they vary. You just kind of fill this kind of grid in as you read. And one of the things that this does is it forces you to see if things that you thought were different, maybe they're not, because they end up having the same descriptors within each of the cells on the rows. So you can have two rows that look very much alike. Sometimes you realize in the end that some of the columns really aren't very important. You thought they were important, but they don't actually end up differentiating in a useful way the rows. So this is a kind of descriptive typology. It doesn't require a lot of theoretical ordering ahead of time, but it's often a useful way if you're mapping out some terrain. So I would encourage you, as you read through things, to just develop a bunch of these. That's why I sent it as a kind of template, because you can delete all the headings and fill it in with other rows and columns. On the other side, there are just two illustrative examples of trying to dimensionalize a conceptual space in a more theoretical way. But this always, the standard form of this is the fabled 2x2 table. That's the upper one here. So we had four types, remember, state economy, capitalist economy, family economy, and social economy. So here's the question. If you have four types, what are the dimensions that underlie these four types that enable you to put them as four cells in a 2x2 table? Whenever you have four of something, and this is a kind of, we call this Eric's stupid, simple-minded rule of concept formation. Whenever you have four of something, there are two underlying dimensions. So if you have four of something, you should be able to find two underlying. Any self-respecting sociologist should be able to come up with two underlying dimensions of any set of four things. A little aphorism, but a bumper sticker. The exercise of actually thinking about this, though, I mean, I'm being glib here, but the exercise, if you have four things, four types of economy in this case, which you really do feel are different, these aren't the same. It's the state economy is not the same as the capitalist economy, and the family economy is different. Well, one of the things you might want to do then is to think of all the different kinds of ways in which you could define underlying dimensions that enable you to organize. Sometimes in doing that, you realize that actually there's more than four, that you're squeezing or that there's only three, that two of them really on the things that are interesting aren't so different. The bottom example takes the same issue, but then dimensionalizes it differently. This is really a three-dimensional table in which one dimension only kicks in for some values on one of the other dimensions. So this way of thinking about it says, let's think of all the different kinds of organizations that there are in an economy. These organizations can be distinguished on the basis of their internal structures. Are they internally democratic or hierarchical bureaucratic? That's one kind of distinction. They also can be distinguished by their purposes. Are they for-profit or not-profit, not-for-profit? Are they profit-making organizations or not-profit-making or profit-oriented organizations? And then among the non-profits, are they public or private? That was just another example. This is really a three-dimensional table collapsed into a two-dimensional space because one of the dimensions only kicks in for one value on another dimension. And here you get six types of organizations. Now, I'm not advocating these particular dimensions or anything. This is just by way of illustration. On lots and lots of problems that you're working on, as a heuristic device for clarifying how you're thinking about it, this is a very useful thing to do. And I would not at all disparage the simple binary 2x2 table. You know, 2x2 is already complicated. The way one usually approaches 2x2 tables is to treat it as binaries. You can also treat it as a space rather than binary. That is, you can treat these as two dimensions which vary on the degree of democracy. So you can not just have full-blown democratic organizations or hierarchical. You could have a dimension that goes from hierarchy to democracy. And then some organizational forms may be intermediate. So it doesn't have to be treated as binary. But it's often, I think, useful to begin simple and then get more complex. So begin with binary 2x2 tables. So again, as you read through various things, these are two devices for concept formation. Okay. So my framework. Trying to embed the social economy within this framework of pathways of social empowerment. And I don't want to give a lecture on this. Some of you have heard me talk about it, others not. Most of you will have had a chance to read the chapters from Envisioning Real Utopias. So what I'd rather do is just open up the floor. A little procedural rule. I like on discussions to have what I call the one hand and two hand procedure. So if you raise one hand, I'll put you down on a list of people who want to talk. If you raise two hands, it means you want to jump into the discussion. So the problem with just lists is you may have something to say that's in direct response to somebody, and by the time we get down to your place on the list, the conversation has moved on. So it's absolutely, the way to do it is to do two hands. That means you jump the queue. It's needless to say this is open to abuse. So it is incumbent on you if you use the two hands that you really are intervening in the discussion on the issue that is being talked about. I also don't want this to be thought of as question and answer to me. Not that I won't answer questions when they're directed at me, but treat the Envisioning Real Utopias in that framework that I laid out as if it were just a book that we happen to have read, and you're talking to each other with me moderating the discussion. the advantage of the interrogations and the agenda is then I can say, okay, now the first agenda item is, and then I would call on the three or four of you who had written it, and so nobody has to then take the bold move of, you know, jumping into the fray without invitation, but... Matt.
Start. The idea of profit would seem to be antithetical to building social power in a way, because it's privately appropriated, and it's if a group, whether it's an individual or a group that's profiting, if they're creating it through surplus value, then they're taking the resources and the influence that comes with having those resources into themselves, necessarily denying it to other people. So can something that is for profit in any respect still be building social power? That's a question.
What do you think? Yeah. Steve.
So, yeah, this is, profit was one of the things I kept thinking about as I was reading each of the readings. So what is it? You know, is it simply surplus after... You know, all the costs have been paid and we've set some wage, is it what's left over, or does it have some dimension of exploitation? Right? Is it an unfair, unjust amount that is taken from a worker, from an organization, et cetera, by someone in a superior social position? So, I mean, there's, I think, in order to move on a lot of issues that the readings revolve around, we have to define profit.
I mean, if you think of profit as, you know, as the return to capital, and the issue then turns out to be how you redistribute that profit. I mean, you can always say that, okay, this is profit, but this is based on exploitation of labor, and so. And you can always say that, you know, just depreciation of machinery and, you know, whatever, and let's say the hours of the person who owns, let's say, the machinery, if we're talking about private ownership of the means of production, then it depends on how you will redistribute rest. I mean, it's then, so I mean, I don't know, it's a difficult question, but it turns out to be the redistribution of the profit turns out to be an important thing. I know it's kind of inherently sounds very inconsistent, but...
So what would the source of profit be for a worker cooperative, I guess, would be where I get, where I'm uncertain. You know, is it a rent that they get from a market interaction where they're overcharging for a good? You know, does it come from the market transaction of interacting with a consumer where they're gaining some kind of rent? Because they control the means of production.
Kathleen.
Yeah, I think that sometimes, is it a miscalculation, you know, in a cooperative situation of, you know, you're establishing, you're guesstimating, I mean, you're in the real world of not really knowing exactly what's going to come out. So do you budget for a profit, or does it come about because you've miscalculated on something? You anticipated there to be a cost here that didn't arise, or you didn't take a certain amount of income in, you know, to cover a cost. So I tend to think that it could be accidental.
Only in the case of a consumer cooperative, where the objective is to provide the service as a cost. In the case of a worker cooperative, where it's us workers providing selling to whoever, potentially to non-workers, then maybe the objective could be to enrich ourselves, literally at the expense of those who aren't workers, who are purchasing our goods or services. So then it would be a rent of that sort.
Okay. It could be self-exploitation also. I mean, you couldn't, if you're not ripping off the market, someone on the other end of the market, you could think of it in terms of ripping off yourself and not taking home as workers the full value of your contribution or whatever.
Well, just the use of profits comes back to what is the definition of profit, because the use of profits is often for growth and for investment in the firm, many things in addition to the worker, you know, wage. So
I guess then the real issue is whether, like, a cooperative has to be kind of like social beneficial in every kind of dimension. You know, whether it's externally and internally kind of beneficial, whether it's just internally, whether it just benefits the members of the cooperative. Now, and I guess that's like an open.
Yeah.
Sure. Let me just make some comments on what's been said so far here. If let's go to a really simple case where there's only an individual producing. So we'll, for the moment, forget about the cooperative aspect. Just an individual produces, and they pay themselves out of what they produce to provide for their own basic subsistence, and they produce more than that. Now, they can do one of two things. They can simply pay themselves more, in which case they have nothing left over, so we don't call it a profit. In effect, what they're doing is saying that my subsistence level is higher than I thought. Right? So by a kind of tautology, the value of my labor is simply whatever I pay myself. And if I'm more productive and pay myself more, that's just, I'm just paying myself more. Or we can say they have actually produced a surplus. Human beings are capable of producing more than they consume. It's one of our traits, and then they've got something left over and they can decide what to do with it. What they can decide to do with it can be either a benefit to others or themselves, but it's not obviously at the expense of others. That is, what they have left over is not because they've taken something from anybody else, it's just that they have produced more themselves. If they've worked, you know, if 20 hours a week of work would have been enough just to provide for their own subsistence, and they work 40 hours a week and have 20 hours of surplus left over because they want to have a vacation in the Bahamas, well, they haven't really raised their subsistence. They've just consumed the surplus in the form of a vacation. Now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to describe that as a profit. The monetary value of the surplus is a profit. And the profit can be generated either exploitatively or not exploitatively, depending upon the context. So that it's entirely possible to generate profits without it being exploitative. Now, it is true, there's this added wrinkle, which traditional Marxism doesn't attend to that much. That is, you can appropriate surplus. You can grab part of the surplus, not just internally from the workers in a production, but through exchange. That's possible through monopoly rents and other devices to appropriate part of the social surplus through exchange relations, not just through production relations. So it's possible that a co-op, if they were in a context where they had some kind of rent appropriating capacity, that they could also be appropriating surplus externally. Usually we assume that co-ops, because they tend to be small, because they're operating in markets that are pretty open, that they're not doing a lot of that, but it could certainly happen. Also, because co-ops tend to be undercapitalized, so this gets to be complicated technical stuff about uneven exchange when you have a high capital intensity production exchanging with low capital intensity production. Some people argue there's a transfer of surplus from the low intensity to the high intensity. That's a complicated set of mechanisms. But it doesn't strike me that profit making per se demonstrates that the form of production isn't a socially empowered one. It could, under some circumstances, but... Yeah.
I guess this kind of leads then into the question where the cooperative is located, you know, how much competition there is from, like, capitalist for-profit producers. So, you know, whether that kind of competition kind of affects the internal kind of, like, mechanism of the cooperative, you know, whether it changes it or not. You know, whether it changes, like, the kind of social aspect of the cooperative, they can, you know, because they have to become more competitive in order to compete with non-cooperatives. and therefore kind of like on a slippery slope towards like a more competitive, more capitalist for-profit corporation.
I was thinking about kind of like the level or the balance between planning and market, and just kind of thinking of how that defines like how people relate to the means of production. Because like you have something like Romer's coupon system where people just invest their coupons, but then you have something and there's no real need for association for that. But when you have a cooperative, you have everyone relating in the same way within to the means of production, so they have to associate with each other somehow. So you have like these contrasting drives between mobilizing like things and mobilizing people, and I think that produces a tension that increases as you get to a higher scale.
That relates to the question of the linkage between the idea of social power, you know, which I make a big deal of in my framing of the set of issues. In defining this conceptual space, I developed this category, social power. So you're making a linkage there between cooperative enterprise and social power because of the necessity of this sort of associational power within a co-op. That wouldn't be present in other forms, necessarily present in other forms of market interaction, if I'm interpreting what you're saying.
Yeah, it kind of struck me like in these readings, especially not the pathways to socialism one, but the other two, both the case studies, is that they treated production and distribution as two like separate processes. And so that kind of like led them to portray like the social economy as something like philanthropic, and I don't think that's a very good or useful framework at all. It's just you have to look at how rights and powers over the means of production relates to how things are distributed and how things are distributed. You have to look at like how they're mutually constituted of each other.
I think that relates what you're saying about the boundaries between those powers. So you, even within, for instance, organizations that are rooted in social power, you're gonna find variations. Some that are gonna be more toward the market, more toward the state than you. But which is a problem of defining the identity of that kind of initiative is to find some kind of core setting or core value that distinguish them. When they come closer and closer to that boundary with other powers that define them as different, maybe it's association. Or maybe there is, or one could even wonder if there is a distinction sometimes when you talk about power, of profit, for instance, when it gets so close to the boundary of the market, so how those powers relate to each other, and then bring the debate on hybrids.
Then, do I understand that you're sort of saying that a group that would have a very strong associational bond may be able to get closer to those boundaries but remain more socially engaged?
Yeah.
I was going to ask something about that, because when you say if they are closer to the market, mm-hmm. it could be like corrosive in the sense that they are going to lose the cohesion and the cooperative sense, and maybe they are going to stop redistributing profits, for example, if they have. But you can also have the other situation in which you are closer to the market, but you are stronger as an organization. No, like you're closer in the sense that you have more exchange with the regular market, you have more clients, I don't know, situations like that. But your internal organization is stronger, is even stronger. No, and it doesn't change necessarily the type of organization that you are. The same with the state, for example, if you're still a co-op, like in this case.
I guess this is then a question of, you know, administrative costs, sort of, you know, basically this is just a question who operates more efficiently, right? Like the capitalist kind of production or the cooperative production. So if the cooperative is competitive, you know, if the social power, if the organization of social power over the economic production is more efficient, then I guess like that would be your case, right? The kind of in competition, they kind of grow stronger. But if that isn't the case, if the capitalist corporation is more efficient, they can produce cheaper, then I guess that would kind of weaken, like even the internal organization for cooperatives. So that would weaken the social power, right? I mean.
Yeah, but that's a different thing, right? Because you're talking about, like, if a co-op is able to survive in a context in which it has competition. Right, mm-hmm. And if the regular company is more efficient, mm-hmm. so that's gonna survive, and the co-op is gonna be like marginal, no?
Yeah.
But that's like a different. It's a different discussion because it's how you survive in a capitalist context, right? Or in a context in which efficiency is the most important value. But the other question is an internal one. Or that's what I understood. Like, both are related, I mean.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm, like, I guess there would be, one would impact the other, right?
I think
so. Yeah.
Mm.
Depending on the level of competition and how efficient.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think it also depends on the context, between the efficiency and the social power over the organization. Sometimes it can be a cost, and it can make a cooperative more less efficient, but sometimes it can make more efficient. Like in the consumer cooperative, for example, because the association, they try more likely to buy there, for example. So it make them more efficient, but sometimes it can make decision making more difficult. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
Let me make a comment on the efficiency issue, since this will come up many times in the course of the semester. Efficiency is not a simple idea. And to equate the concept, the more general abstract concept, to capitalist efficiency, I think, is a significant problem. Capitalist production does not have to worry about the externalities of its own production. And one of the ways that capitalism is efficient, in quotes, is by externalizing, especially intergenerationally, but also synchronically, all sorts of costs, imposing them on others and not having to count them as costs. The obvious example is pollution. But depletion of resources is another example, where you're imposing costs on future generations which you don't have to pay for, and therefore you're efficient. Right? It's not a simple idea. A co-op could be unable to compete effectively on capitalist terms with capitalist firms and yet be vastly more efficient with respect to all the costs that we would value from a social point of view. It's just there's no way for them to internalize the positive externalities in their cost structure in ways that make it look like on their balance sheet they're as efficient as capitalist firms. That then, I think, raises another way of thinking about some of these questions. What do each of these types of economies do in order to ensure their reproduction? So one way of thinking about that is, what do they do when they get into trouble, when they have some problem. Do co-ops behave differently when they're unable to cover their own costs? I mean, co-ops have to cover their costs of production. They can run into trouble being able to do so. Do they behave differently than when a capitalist firm does, or when a family does, or when the state does? So when the state does, they have all sorts of strategies available to them that firms don't have. You know, they can print money, they can increase taxes, they can do all sorts of things because they have coercion as a basic capacity to reproduce themselves, that is, to acquire the resources needed to remain in existence. Capitalist firms sometimes behave like states. You know, they do have thugs and ways of appropriating, but you know, basically, capitalist firms don't have that capacity. They can act on the state, perhaps get the state to give them subsidies. That's basically using coercive capacity, but it's at arm's length. They have to get somebody else to do it. Cooperatives have a capacity to increase what could be called voluntary contributions. In the social economy in general, when they get into trouble, they make appeals to people on the basis of values, solidarities, reciprocities, to contribute. Not in market sense, with no, that is, you're not investing with a return, you're asking people to contribute. So that happens all the time in co-ops. Including consumer co-ops. You know, in consumer co-ops, they get volunteers to come in and help when there's some issue around shortfalls, whatever. So that's one way to kind of get at what's distinctively socially empowered about these forms is, can they draw on voluntary contribution as a way of surviving when they hit trouble? Now, there are special cases of capitalist firms which are very socially embedded and also can call on voluntary contributions in the form of workers willingly, not just with the threat, but willingly working extra without pay because of a sense of loyalty which reflects reciprocities and solidarities that have built. You know, there are family firms that have that character occasionally. Well, I think when that's true, they're not actually acting like capitalist firms. They've become more like a social economy. There's a social economy aspect to a firm that can draw on voluntary contribution as a way of surviving when it hits difficulties. So, I mean, that was sort of two counterpoints to some of the... The efficiency thing is, though, really, that's crucial, and that's going to come up a lot during the semester. How do we... And once you recognize that there is this huge problem of any social economy activity in a capitalist world having to behave on capitalist efficiency grounds, and how can we get around that? What sorts of mechanisms might there be to buffer those firms and enable them to operate on social efficiency terms, not capitalist efficiency terms? Yeah, Steve.
But even if we look strictly at capitalist efficiency terms, why should capitalist enterprises be more efficient? I would think they would be less, or they should be able to cooperatives should be able to outcompete them, because if we believe that there's some unjust earned income from the ownership of the means of production, right? Theoretically, we should be able to increase workers' wages and still sell our products, produce our products at a lower price. Why would capitalists be able to outcompete, other than access to capital required to start the cooperative? Why would a capitalist firm be able to outcompete a cooperative, theoretically?
Kathleen?
I mean, I can talk about it in terms of, like, food co-ops, you know, and the externalities that Eric was talking about the cost of food, right? There's some food that's very cheap to produce because it's not done while preserving kind of environmental integrity or the wages of the workers or any of those things. So, you know, if a food co-op does that, says, yes, we are in fact going to do all those things, that is going to be less efficient, aka more expensive, to do it, because they're taking those costs into account for the price that they're members of the co-op are paying for those goods, okay, right, versus a customer, you know, at a capitalist grocery that looks for, right, the cheapest food. It doesn't necessarily care about the environmental impact, because customers doesn't. Its customers only looking at the economic component, how economically efficient or how capitalistically efficient you are versus socially efficient you would be. And that food is going to be a different cost. It's going to be a different price, because the one price involves, the co-op's price involves the cost of actual production, and the capitalist's price involves, externalizes those costs. So it's a cheaper price.
David? Well, but I mean, I just maybe in response to what you were saying, I think, you know, there can be green capitalists too that do that, that take that same strategy. And that might not be specifically what makes cooperatives different from capitalism. Yeah. Because, you know, you have all kinds of sort of niche market aiming green, completely capitalist enterprises.
And you could have a non-green co-op, too.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They could externalize the same
and
costs.
And it seems to me that also, if you pay attention to the role of the state, then the efficiency or lack of efficiency is defined by what any firm, a co-op, is allowed to do. Because you can imagine, you know, a firm that can't act efficiently the way we're talking about it because the state is saying you have to internalize those costs. So, I mean, it's how the state decides to regulate the two other spheres, which for me in the sort of tripartite, you've got the social power, the economic power, and the state power, feels like some of the pathways, which you say don't directly involve the state, for me feel like they really do involve the state in setting the rules of the game.
Oh, sure. At least there's some places where I make the distinction between the direct involvement of the state versus the rule setting. Ordinary capitalist production requires property rights to be enforced, and that requires a state. So there's the kind of parameter setting role of the state, which is present for all types of economic activity, and then there's the direct involvement of the state in organizing production itself. And so when I'm talking about a workers' co-op not working through the state, I'm referring to that aspect. I agree. Absolutely, the state is implicated in all of them. Yeah.
I guess just back to the efficiency in the worker co-ops, it's, you know, if you look at why are capitalist firms so efficient? You know, some people argue that ownership is all in the hands of investors, and so there's only one real goal, which is to increase the value of your investment. And that in a worker co-op, certainly there's multiple goals. I mean, increasing the value of your investment may be a goal for those owners, but they have many other goals that they're trying to achieve. And because they have all those different goals, then there's a cost to governance that is higher than in the capitalist firms. And because there are so many other reasons that worker co-ops should actually be very efficient for some of the things that we've talked about, you know, at least like Henry Hansman, who's written on this, says that the only logical conclusion is cost of governance because of these multiple needs that the workers have. And, you know, I don't necessarily totally agree with it, but I think it's an interesting issue to dissect.
I would also emphasize two other features which are a problem for isolated worker co-ops. So if we want to distinguish the problem of efficiency, again, just in the ordinary capitalist sense here, but the problem of efficiency of a firm operating in a purely capitalist environment, a cooperative firm, versus a cooperative that's enmeshed in a cooperative environment with other co-ops. That's which we'll get some exposure to when we talk about the Middle Italy case. I think there's a couple of other issues. One is the how every firm, co-op or not, needs loans in order to deal with things like inventory management and operating capital, quite apart from investments, you know, for long-term growth and the like. If you're, take a grocery co-op as a simple example, you have to buy all your inventory before you sell it. You have to have a way of doing that. The standard way that a grocery store buys all of its inventory before it sells it is it has short-term loans, which it turns over very rapidly and pays back and so on. You get operating loans of various sorts, as opposed to having a huge reserve of cash that you can immediately pay for everything. Now, this can take the form of you get the supply and then you get billed a month later. The question is the economies of scale, the interest rates you have to pay on that. On all these things, co-ops are at a big disadvantage. They operate on lower economies of scale. In grocery stores, that's a huge problem. You know, Kohl's grocery stores can buy the exact same thing from wholesalers at below what the Willie Street Co-op has to pay for it. I mean, Willie Street Co-op buys other things, but the things that they buy that are the same. So operating in a capitalist environment, co-ops are at a disadvantage. They also have a particular problem, I think, around technology. And this may be an area where the difference between capitalist firms in many areas and co-ops is declining, not increasing. But that is, in order to have the most productive technology, in the past you needed particular access to capital, which meant that you had to be at a certain scale to get access to the capital, and banks had to be willing to loan you money to acquire that capital. Now, capital intensity in many areas is declining, not increasing, because of information technologies. And information technologies are cheap rather than expensive compared to the past. So it could be that there's all sorts of areas that are being opened up for cooperatives because the capital intensity requirements of production are lower. And then one final issue. This is of a different character. The most talented and skilled people who have a choice between working in a co-op under internally egalitarian conditions or in a capitalist firm under inegalitarian conditions, in a capitalist environment will have much higher income potentials outside of co-ops than inside of co-ops. The most, you know, technically skilled, highly trained labor. So it requires, therefore, a higher threshold of ideological commitment on the part of high-skilled people to stay in a co-op than to opt for a capitalist alternative. If the co-op itself is to be organized on egalitarian grounds, that if it's not going to have its internal inequalities replicate the capitalist firm, there's therefore a constant pressure of a kind of brain drain from those people who hone their skills in a co-op, become extremely adept and knowledgeable. They get lured away. In Argentina, in the crisis of the beginning of the 2000s, there were several hundred factories that were taken over by workers called recovered factories. Basically, they were factories abandoned by their owners. The workers hadn't been paid, so the workers just stayed and took it over and started running these factories. There's 270 of them still around that are in varying states of legal limbo. Some of them have become cooperative, some of them are not. The owners are now trying to get some of them back. You know, it's a complicated kind of situation. One of the problems is that those that were really successful, you know, you have some incredibly energetic and charismatic manager who really managed to get everybody working together and get the thing running well, the wage offers that they then would get from private corporations were 10 times what they could earn in the co-op. You know, so that the talent gets lured away. That's because it's operating in a capitalist environment where inegalitarian principles of wage distribution, which are not, you know, there's nothing natural about those inequalities. That's just what capitalists can pay because they can generate profit-making enterprises by offering that degree of inequality to grab the best people from one type of enterprise or another. That would be different if co-ops operated in a cooperative environment. Or if you had the state impose such severe progressivity to wage inequality that it wouldn't pay to generate such inequality. So those are all reasons why co-ops become less competitive. They have trouble retaining the highest talent without eroding the egalitarian principles internally, and they have trouble getting capital at competitive interest rates. Yeah.
Well, I was just trying to think about those as to whether they are all sort of principled problems that cooperatives would face at any time, or where they're sort of specific. I.e., the question of scale seems, and purchasing without economies of scale seems to be a problem that won't always necessarily plague co-ops. I.e., if there are more and if they become bigger, it might not. But the question of attracting people with higher salaries is something that is likely to potentially always sort of be principal play co-ops. And also the one that you raised is the idea of an administrative cost could, or an organizational cost could potentially always